Failure is not an option.
What difference at this point does it make?
Nobody said it was going to be fun.
This is Real Talk, a fearless, poignant, and intrepid show where truth speaks louder than words. This is Real Talk with your host, Audrey Russo.
The shame, not of this world, so we live on the run. We keep our eyes set, on what is to come.
It happened before. It will happen again. It's just a question of when.
Time's a luxury we don't have.
Hey everyone, this is Gary Busey, man. And if you haven't already done so, well, feel free to do so. Ha ha! You're listening to Audrey Russo on Real Talk. Yeah!
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, this is Audrey Russo, and you're listening to Real Talk. Well, it's been 14 years since 9/11, yet our leaders still remain ignorant on the fascist ideology of Islam. It's time for them to return to school for some world history, and I do believe they will be surprised at what they missed 1,400 years ago. And there continues to be this relentless push by the OIC, led by the Saudis, for censoring free expression that offends religion. Now, would you find it surprising that the only religion they are protecting is Islam? Well, we're going to discuss this and more with my next guest. For my new listeners, Raymond Ibrahim is, among other distinguished positions, a Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center and a CBN News contributor. He's a guest lecturer at universities and governmental agencies, and he's testified before Congress regarding the abstract failures that governs American dialogue concerning Islam. He's also the author of several books, including The Al-Qaeda Reader and his latest release, Crucified Again, Exposing Islam's New War on Christians. It's my great pleasure to give a Real Talk welcome back to Raymond Ibrahim. Hey, Raymond.
Hi, Audrey. Good to be with you again.
Yeah, it's great to have you back with us, and we're going to jump right in here. One of the key players in the push for blasphemy laws at the UN seems to be a wee bit hypocritical. Saudi Arabia wants Western cartoonists, comedians, and others to stop mocking the religious beliefs and symbols of Islam. Now, Raymond, is it clear to the West that this is not to the benefit of anyone but Muslims because it reinforces Sharia Islamic law?
Well, it's probably clear to anyone who sits and thinks about it and has the objective facts and really considers it, but I don't know if the mainstream media, political leaders are making the connections. But as you indicated, it's almost, to me at least, a bit surreal, the things that Saudi Arabia is doing and the way it's pontificating to the international community, to the West specifically, about the need to criminalize vilifying or insulting any symbols of religion, et cetera, et cetera. But it's worse than that because the article I wrote is based on the Saudi Gazette. This is a Saudi newspaper, and it came out in July 26th. And the things that it said are just ludicrous. And I can even read a few of the excerpts to you. So here's an I'm quoting right now from the Saudi Gazette. It says, addressing an international symposium on media coverage of religious symbols based on international law, okay, et cetera, et cetera. The kingdom emphasized years ago that the international community must act urgently to confront ethnic, religious, and cultural intolerance, which has become widespread in all communities and peoples of the world. Now, the problem here is that I can think of few countries that it is official policy to discriminate based on ethnicity and religion and culture than Saudi Arabia. And so while Saudi Arabia is upset that individual artists or whatever, comedians, just individual people are expressing themselves, and it's not state policy. So, for example, Charlie Hebdo, you know, they make their cartoon mocking Muhammad and, of course, and Jesus and Moses and everyone else. That's not representative of course, the French government. It's just an individual thing. Now, in Saudi Arabia, it's the actual government, the authority itself, who is openly persecuting every other religion, openly discriminating against everyone who's not of the Islamic faith, and discriminating against non-Arabs. If you're black, it's a terrible thing to be black in Saudi Arabia. You're treated as a slave. Same thing for Indonesians, Filipinos, etc., who go there and work, and this is well known. This is a country that won't allow a single church to stand or a single synagogue, and yet it's telling the West that it needs to work on its human rights record and start eliminating its ethnic, religious, and cultural intolerance. And so it's just it's amazing. And this is being done at a respected symposium in Europe, and I believe 16 European nations were there listening. And it's just mind-boggling that they could do this, that Saudi Arabia says this with a straight face, and all these people are sitting there listening to it with a straight face.
Am I correct that they don't allow Christians or Jews to walk around with Stars of David or the cross around their neck?
Yeah, if you are in possession of a single Bible, you could be beheaded. Same thing with the Star of David, the crucifix, any kind of religious symbol. And this leads to really an irony that I don't think the Saudis and all these other Muslims at the OIC and so forth who are trying to pull this or push this blasphemy law. The irony is that because as you were indicating, they're only concerned, of course, about Islam, but they couch it in sort of universal terms. And they say, don't offend religious symbols, don't offend this. Well, if we actually had a law like that, I think the first thing that would be banned would be the Quran and Islam subsequently itself. Because this is the only religion that vilifies the symbols of other religions, that vilifies the religions themselves by name. So, for example, you can say Jews and Christians and Hindus have differences, but you don't find in any of these books, Hindus mentioning Jews as bad guys or vice versa, or Christians and so forth. But in the Quran, Jews and Christians are named, and both of them are attacked and vilified and condemned. And, a curse of God and Allah is to fall upon them. May they suffer in hell and so forth. So imagine if a book comes out in the West saying this. Of course, Muslims will get angry and they'll say this is blasphemy. It should be banned, etc. So you see that actually this law they're trying to pull, if it was in effect and we were objective, the first thing that would be banned would be Islam entirely.
Yeah, exactly. when it comes to their blasphemy laws, are they specific or are they vague and customizable?
The blasphemy laws, well, all these countries are different depending on the kind of governments they have and so forth. But the one main country that I'll give you a perfect example is Pakistan. They really have it codified in the government. And that's why I don't think a week passes without me reading some story about some Christian being accused of blasphemy. Muslims go riot, try to kill him, sometimes kill him or her. And oftentimes it's a false accusation. But the way the nature of it, and this is based on Sharia, if a Muslim accuses a Christian's word in self-defense is null and void because he's just an infidel, and who cares? He's obviously lying. So what Muslims are doing is anytime they want to get even with a Christian neighbor or whatever the case may be, they're feeling vindictive, they immediately start screaming, oh, this guy insulted Islam, this guy insulted Muhammad, and so forth. And then people just riot and attack him. And Saudi Arabia has the same thing. But the really touchy spot for Muslims, really from day one, has been Muhammad. So anything that is offensive, insulting, or whatever about Muhammad, and it's hard not to find such things since the Islamic books themselves are riddled with things that to normal people would be considered insulting to attribute to your prophet, but they're there. So, for example, Western people mock Muhammad or condemn him because he was married, engaged, whatever, to a 9, 12-year-old, whatever the years are, 9-year-old, I think is the common one, Aisha. Well, that's pedophilia, so, you know, we can say that and we can just honestly discuss it. We're not even trying to mock him, but that's enough to make Muslims riot, because if he did it, it must be great, and you can't judge it. So that's the sort of thing with the blasphemy.
This is insane. Now, as I mentioned in the intro, it's now 14 years. We're coming upon the remembrance of 9/11. And thanks to people like you, Raymond, there is more info on the ideology of Islam available than ever before. And yet, the majority of politicians, the media, academia, still insist upon remaining ignorant. They believe that the spread of Islam was not by the sword, but rather, as you state in your recent article, from sheer conviction that the ancestors of today's 1.5 billion Muslims all converted to Islam due to its intrinsic appeal. Why is this incredibly false?
Thanks, Audrey. Well, what I tried to do with this article is I point out that if you look at the historical sources, both Muslim historical sources and non-Muslim make clear that Islam was spread by the sword. So if you read, I can rattle off all these names. It's irrelevant at this point of top Islamic historians throughout the medieval era who recorded the history of Islam, and they just make it very plain. It was spread by the sword, and that's great because that's what Allah wanted, so forth and so forth. And non-Muslim historians recorded the same thing. But as I've started to understand, we're living in a very ahistorical society that just has basically jettisoned all reality, all history out the door. It doesn't matter anymore. It's based on our feelings and what we want to believe. Or to put it differently, our philosophies and ideals are now taking precedence of reality and history. And so if we have the first premise, for example, multiculturalism is a premise that we accept, then if I come and show you X, Y, and Z is recorded in history, all of it making Islam and Muslims look bad, you'll just ignore it because it doesn't fit into your paradigm, the multicultural thing. So what I was trying to do with this article is to show that just common sense alone indicates that Islam spread through violence and persecution. And I used Egypt as a paradigm because it's one of the most important Islamic nations, and we have a lot of the histories recorded about what happened there. And what I tried to point out is, most people don't know this, but in the 7th century, Egypt was a very Christian nation. It had St. Mark, according to tradition, started proselytizing in the 1st century and so forth. It became very Christian in the 4th century. So by the 7th century, it was more or less a very heavily Christian majority. And things like, until now, we keep discovering things like the oldest biblical parchments are in Egypt, the oldest pictures of Christ are in Egypt. So we have a lot of evidence it was a very Christian nation. Alexandria was one of the original three sees of Christendom, the other two being Rome and Antioch. Okay, so what happened? That's the question. How is it that now, from being almost 100%, Christians are 10%, if it wasn't violence and persecution and so forth? And to do this, you have to go back and try to put your mind or understand the medieval mindset. And I was talking about Christianity. In the medieval era, if you're born, let's say, in Europe, in the medieval era, you're a Christian, you're raised as a Christian, the majority of the people, and there's no alternative. It's not like today where people think we can change our religions like we change our shoes. It's just no big deal. That was a heavy thing. It would be traumatizing for a person who's born as a Christian or born as a Jew or born as a Muslim to actually break away from that faith, because that faith is his identity, his people, his worldview. There is no alternative narrative. And so keep that in mind, that here you're talking about Egypt, 7th century, it's almost entirely Christian, and they have this very hardcore, you can even say if you want, a primitive mentality that this is truth and to leave it is to go to hell and so forth. So in that context, if in fact, as the apologists say, Islam came and did not use violence and did not do anything bad and gave Christians and Jews and others freedom to keep their faith, all they have to do is just pay a small little tax, and et cetera, et cetera, wouldn't you think Egypt would have stayed Christian majority? That's the common sense. Of course it would have, you know what I mean? And so, well, then what happened? So what happened is now we make a full circle and we go back to the historical text and we see what happens. And I'm always, it comes to my mind, one of my favorite anecdotes, which is recorded by Al-Makrizi, a medieval Muslim historian of Egypt. He talks about all of these, he writes these anecdotes of churches being attacked and burned and Christians being abducted and enslaved and raped and held hostage, all the things that the Islamic State and others are doing today, of course. And then after one particularly egregious anecdote where one crazy caliph burned, according to this historian, 30,000 churches in Egypt and Syria, and that alone, that number again reminds you how Christian that region was, he writes, this historian, that and under these circumstances, a great many Copts and Christians became Muslims, Allah Akbar. So, you know, it's very plain to you that, you know, that right there indicates why they converted to Islam. And so, you know, both common sense, we have a plethora of common sense, or we have a lot of common sense that indicates it, but we have a plethora of historical sources. And so you combine the two, and it's just mind-boggling that people are still sitting here arguing no Islam through spread through peace and so forth.
Yeah. Come on, Raymond. Wasn't it Islam's intrinsic appeal? Yeah, right.
Yeah, that, well, you know, one cleric, not sorry, well, he's Egyptian, but he's the Muslim Brotherhood spiritual father, Yusuf al-Qaradawi. I'm sure you've heard of him. He's on record, I watched a show of him on TV, saying basically that if Islam did not have the apostasy or ridda law, which is basically if you try to break away from Islam, we'd kill you, that it would have died at the time of the Prophet. There would not be any Muslims. And his point is very clear, that if it wasn't because of violence and coercion and threats, Muslims would have left Islam right away. And in fact, that's what happened. After Muhammad died, a huge majority of the original nominal Muslims who had joined his banner to go on jihad and plunder broke away and said, all right, you know, it was good while it lasted, let's move on. And then the first caliph, Abu Bakr, then he waged another jihad, and it was called the Ridda Wars, and the things that he and the original first, you know, caliph and his armies did to these Arabs makes what ISIS is doing pale in comparison, totally. I mean, he had huge groups of Arabs set on fire, burned alive, all of them decapitated, lines of crucified Arabs, all this because they didn't want to be a Muslim. So you see, it's a perpetual cycle. You coerce, you threaten, you financially bleed the infidel who lives under you until they, through the ages, like the Copts, for example, went from being 100% to 10%. Why? Because they all converted through the ages and through persecution. And then once you're a Muslim, or even if you're just born into Islam, then you can't leave it. And so obviously, keep this in mind when you hear Muslims boasting about how Islam is the fastest growing religion in the world and so forth, because you can't leave it. You're being threatened if you do.
That's why. Yeah, that's an insurance policy,
yeah.
Right? Yeah,
exactly.
That's terrible. Yeah, and we go back to the mafia again. Anyway.
yeah, exactly.
Right? You know, and again, with Western, Western media leaders, you know, academia, how intractable they are on the nature of Islam is incredible. When you consider today, we have evidence in paintings from long ago of the violent Islamic campaigns, you know, from 1400 years ago. And then in the 20th century, we actually have the photos of Muslim Turks posing, which is really hideous, I'm sorry, listeners, with the severed heads of Armenians they beheaded in their genocide against Christians. Why is this still not enough for the West?
It is mind-boggling, and I don't know. And I think, like I said, because instead of being realistic people and taking the facts and just building, you know, you have your first premise, then your second premise, third conclusion, so forth, we don't do that because our first premise is a set of principles, but they're not factual. They're idealistic. There are things like multiculturalism. There are things like religious relativism. There's things, you know, the idea that, okay, the white man is the root of all evil. And if you're brown, you have to be a victim, basically. So all these are like the first principles and premises. Now, if you come in now and put another premise and you try to put on top of it that goes against that first premise, then it can't work and it gets rejected. Mm-hmm. So history gets rejected, the Quran and its literalism gets rejected, the Hadith, every day a crazy sheikh or clerk comes on video saying basically what I just said and a lot of negative things about Islam, but of course he's saying it in a good way, that gets rejected. The Islamic State doing what they're doing, and they're quoting literally how Muhammad did the same thing, that gets rejected. Why? Because it doesn't fit their narrative, their paradigm of multiculturalism. So they're basically sacrificing reality in order to keep propping up this false edifice that they created that's just based on false ideals.
Yeah, I guess it's a little cognitive dissonance there, that's all.
Yeah.
They got all kinds of problems.
Definitely.
Raymond, doesn't the Quran command that Muslims convert non-Muslims, if necessary, through violence?
Well, the Quran, what it says is, the Quran's a tricky book. You know, there's a famous, if you're talking to a Muslim apologist right now, he would jump all over you and go, well, in fact, the Quran says there's no coercion in Islam. And in fact, that is a verse there. But the Quran is also full of other contradictions, and the ulama or the scholars, you know, they arranged it in a way by abrogating older verses by newer verses, and usually the tolerant ones, like no compulsion or coercion in religion, are the older ones. But then you come to a verse like the sword verse, as Muslims call it, which is 9:5, and it says, slay the idolater wherever you find him. And then the people of the book, the Jews and Christians, they're in 9:29, and it says, fight them until they are subjugated, pay tribute, or unless they convert, or fight them to the death, so they have no choice. So in theory, one could argue that Islam does not promote forced conversion. However, in practice, it has been the case all throughout history. And I think one of the reasons is because Muslims, as they are, in the back of their heads, when they're compelling someone to convert or making his life miserable or abducting a woman and raping her and marrying her and making her convert, they think they're being altruistic because deep down inside they can always argue, well, I'm actually doing this person a favor by pushing him into Islam because he's not going to go to hell if he becomes like one of us. And I've read this, so this is sort of the psychological justification and why it happens. Yeah, though strictly speaking, if you're a pagan or if you're a non-Christian or a non-Jew, yes, you either convert or die. So in a way, that is forced conversion. And for the rest, Christians and Jews, you just live a miserable life, and you're a third-class dhimmi, etc., and you can exist. But in practice, it's just always been, they've been pressured. And the less Christians there are, so for example, go back to the Egypt paradigm, the persecution, it's funny because when Egypt was conquered by Muslims, the Christians were still the majority, because you just had a few Arabs there who were the overlords. And it was actually like that for centuries. But the more the Muslims started growing in numbers, whether by reproduction or moving in from Arabia or whatever, or Christians converting, and Christians shrank in numbers, the more the violence grew. And that's just what I call Islam's rule of number, which is the more Muslims there are, like vis-a-vis a non-Muslim group, the more violence you're going to see and persecution. And so it really snowballed in Egypt during what's called the Mamluk era, which is right around 1200 A.D., and at that point, the Copts were just converting in droves to Islam. It got to the point where if you spoke the Coptic language, they would cut your tongue off. You had to speak exclusively Arabic, and that's why today Copts don't know Coptic. It's just a liturgical language, right? So that's the hidden true history of Islam. While people like John McCain sit and tell you, you know, ISIS has absolutely nothing to do with Islam. In fact, they do have everything to do with it.
Yeah, sure. The Reformation, right?
Yes,
unbelievable. Now, a very important question, Raymond. Where can the listeners follow and support your excellent work and purchase your books?
Well, thanks, Audrey. The best place is just my website, myfirstandlastname.com, raymondibrahim.com. And all my articles and videos appear there and links to my books on Amazon and also a donate button whoever would like to support the website's existence. That would be appreciated. So, R-A-Y-M-O-N-D-I-B-R-A-H-I-M.com.
Excellent. You're also in social media, right?
I'm on Facebook and Twitter.
Facebook and Twitter. Okay, good. And, of course, as always, I'll have all that information and links in my after show. Thanks so much, Raymond, for sharing with us again. And till your next visit, may God bless you and your work. Bye for now.
You too. You too. Thanks, Audrey.
Thank you.